That's number four. All right. Welcome back. You survived the weekend. Do we have announcements? No. Just that in case you missed it, the due date for paper six is next week, week from today. That was on the website. Did I send an email? I didn't. Okay. I announced it in class, and it's on the website. Okay. Questions? You're easy. You're stunned. Okay, here we go. We were talking about what happens when couples go from being a couple to being parents, and we had talked briefly about the changes in roles and the changes that are likely to happen in the microsystem as people become parents, as they become pregnant. And we were talking, as we ended class on Wednesday, about image making and the planning or lack of planning that people go through as they think about what kind of parents they want to be and how they want their children to grow up. So I want to take off from there and look a little bit about at what happens during pregnancy and at the birth of the child. And I had an article that, if you didn't pick up, called How My Son Got His Name, which describes one father's transition through the birth of his child and coping with the child's brief stay in the intensive care unit. What he's describing is the difference between the image of birth that he and his wife have had and the reality of the birth, and then the importance of finding a name for his son, their son, that would fit the image that they were revising after the child was born. So the notion of image making comes from Galinsky's book, which you have been reading, The Six Stages of Parenthood, and image making is the very first stage. I want to talk about the book a little bit, because what Galinsky does is talk about the new relationships that are happening as a child is born. But when the child is born, the microsystem is changed, and as the baby comes into that microsystem, we recall Proposition C from Bronfenbrenner, that as one person in a dyad changes, the other person is likely to go through developmental change as well. So with the baby, development is very rapid. And the parent-child dyad is going to be constantly adapting to the changes that the baby goes through. Galinsky's book is designed around the changes that happen as the baby develops, and she describes six stages, beginning with image making, and suggests that in each stage, the baby has different tasks, different accomplishments, different challenges, and each of those accomplishments and challenges present new opportunities and challenges for the parent. Yeah. This is on the website. And as the baby changes, the parent-child transactions change, and each stage presents different specific challenges and issues for the parent. The parent has a developmental history that the parent brings into the relationship with the baby, and a developmental history about parenting based on the parent's own experience. So each parent and child dyad creates a unique relationship based on the parent's history and the issues presented by that particular child. So what Galinsky does is illustrate the way the baby's development drives the transaction. Parents would be quite happy to just stay the way they are. They're grown-ups by the time they become parents, so you all know that when you grow up, you won't change anymore, right? When you're adults, right? It's just all the same thing over and over and over again. That was tongue-in-cheek. You also know that. But your development will be much slower than the development of an infant or toddler or young child. Infants and toddlers and young children become very, very different very quickly. And as they do that, the transaction with the parent has to change. That means that the parent's development, at least within the relationship with the child, the parent's development is speeding up as the child develops. It's a transaction driven by the development of the child. It's very different to take care of a one-month-old than it is to take care of a six-month-old or a nine-month-old or a one-year-old. They are very different creatures. They present different issues. The transactions with them, with infants and toddlers, are constantly changing. So just about the time you think you've got it together and have figured out how to deal with this child in an appropriate way, in an effective way, the child changes again. So parents, in one sense, are always playing catch-up. In the transaction, the child is developing more quickly than the parent, and the parent is always responding. It's very difficult to get ahead of the child and anticipate what the child is going to do next. If you're a really on top of it parent and you have a lot of experience, you can probably do that. But most of us quit having children before we get to that point of really understanding how to do it, which is why daycare providers and early childhood educators are so good for us, because they go through it over and over again, so they know what the challenges are. And after you've been through it for several years with dozens of children, you have a pretty good sense of what's coming. Pediatricians sometimes are pretty good about it. Brazelton, who's a famous pediatrician, author of many books on parenting and children, takes this transactional view very seriously, and in his training of residents in pediatrics, teaches them what he calls anticipatory guidance. And that means that you take the changes that are going to take place in the baby, as you can predict those within a reasonable framework. And instead of having the well baby visits at nice, simple times, like every 3 months, which most pediatricians still do, and then lean that out to 6 months, with no attention to what the baby is going through or what the parents are going through, Brazelton has a schedule for, remind me to get a copy of his schedule, Brazelton has a schedule that's based on what the baby is likely to be adding to its repertoire, and therefore what the parents are going to have to be responding to. And he sets the well child visits just before the baby is likely to be adding some new skill, such as crawling or walking or talking. And those don't come at regular 3 or 6 month intervals, so he schedules those out, and that allows him to, as he says, play wizard with the parents. The parents come in and he finds out what's going on now and takes care of whatever issues the parents have. But then he's able to alert them. Well, in the next couple of months, before I see you again, your baby is going to be crawling. And he's going to be getting away from you faster, and he's going to be getting into different kinds of trouble. How are you going to deal with that? How are you going to cope with that? What difference is it going to make in your parenting? So Brazelton takes this notion that you have a transaction driven by the child's developments and develops his pediatric schedule around what those changes are likely to be so that he can advise the parents in advance about what they might be facing during the next period. Okay. We don't know if it works or not, but it certainly makes sense that if parents are alerted, oh, okay, you know what the doctor said? The doctor said the kid's going to start crawling pretty soon. We see him up on his hands and knees, so I guess he's probably right. When he starts crawling, life is going to change. Mobile children, children who can cover territory very quickly, create a different challenge for parents. The kid is sitting on his back and stays where you put him and maybe rolls over so you don't put him near the edge of anything, presents a different kind of challenge than the kid who is fast enough to be out of sight, around the corner, through the door, into whatever's there before you're aware that the child has moved. And that's what crawling allows kids to do. Walking allows them to go even faster and to reach taller things. So those are the challenges. Now, in addition to having the transaction with the child, you also have the transaction between the parents. So, as you know, you've got mom and child creating a dyadic relationship, but you also have dad and child. And before you had the child, you had mom and dad, except they were husband and wife. So their roles were different. And the creation of this child is going to change their relationship. Now, they have a history. The parents have a dyad that has a history. And that reflects the experience each parent brought into the relationship from childhood. So each of them has a parenting history. Each of them has perhaps a different image. Each of them has a different expectation for his or her role and for the way those roles are going to transact with each other. Not the roles with the child, they have that, but they also have a set of expectations for who's going to do what and how their relationship is going to adapt to being parents. So mom comes into this parenthood for the first time with some set of assumptions about not only her relationship with the child and what the child is going to be like, that image, but she also has the image of the marriage, the couplehood, as it's going to play out now that they're adding the new roles. Dad also has his image of what the marriage is going to be like now that they have children. And if I can just adopt a stereotype for a minute, it's false unless it fits in your case. So he is assuming that since this is a little boy, we're going to start playing catch when, about 3 weeks or 4 weeks of age. That's what fatherhood is all about. We're going to do the sports. We're going to watch movies together. We're going to ride bikes. And this is my role. I get to do all these things. He's going to be surprised because, in fact, the role is going to be changing diapers and wiping chins for a while. Okay, so that image has to change. Her role is that she's going to have the Gerber baby, and it's going to be beautiful, and it's going to smile all the time, and it's going to love her and nurse easily and whatever else is part of that image. And she, of course, has to adapt to the fact that that's not what she gets. The Gerber baby is 6 months old, and it takes 6 months of feeding, wiping, and all that stuff before you get that nice little baby that does smile a lot and looks like it didn't come out of a automobile accident. Newborns look like they've been run over. Their heads are pointed. They're red, white, and blue. They're really kind of ugly. Their eyes are squinted up and they cry a lot. It's not the Gerber baby. It's not the one on the box. So they both have to adapt to the reality that they have. They also come into this with a view that now they are going to be the happy couple. This child is completing their family. So here we are. You're mom, I'm dad. I'm mom, you're dad, here's the baby. And we're going to support each other. And this is going to make our relationship closer. We're going to be more fulfilled. We're going to have a chance to really show the world that we can do this better than our own parents did, that we're up to this task. And what they get is, she has postpartum depression. She's exhausted. She expects him to get up and feed the baby, or at least bring it into bed so that she can feed it. He has turned out to be one of those people who doesn't wake up in the middle of the night. It's a very important skill for fathers to develop, that nothing will wake them up. Then they get their sleep, because they have to go to work in the morning, and they can't afford not to have enough sleep. Meanwhile, she's turning into a zombie who's resenting him, and he deserves to be resented, and he doesn't have clue what he really is supposed to do. And they start squabbling about the fact that the house isn't as clean as it used to be, and her mother is still there, and that wasn't anticipated, and her mother is very intrusive. You can add as many complications as you would like to that scenario, but all of the movies that make fun of new parents and present new parenthood as a disaster have a large, more than a grain. They have a large fruitcake full of truth to them. I sometimes give a lecture called When Two Become Three, How to Ruin a Perfectly Good Relationship. Yeah. Because that's what babies have the potential to do. That's not the image. Nobody anticipates that. But in fact, if the images of mom and dad are unrealistic and their images of the marriage after the child comes don't include, okay, this is going to be a real challenge for our couplehood. And it's going to stress us, it's going to bring us to the brink, and it's going to require both of us to adapt all aspects of our mesosystems so that we can support each other through what is going to be a very trying time as we go through all the adaptations of learning how to be parents and remember that we once loved each other. And we still should, and we are still a couple, and we need to support each other. That's the challenge. And many couples don't come up to that challenge particularly well. So it's a difficult change in all aspects of the ecosystem when you add a child, just a tiny, you know, just 7 or 8 pounds, that's all. You know? Little, it's human, you love it, you add it, it changes your entire ecosystem, your relationship, messes up your microsystem, this house, apartment, whatever that you've tried to put together, and it makes it very difficult to continue to be a loving couple if one or both of you also have full-time or more jobs, if you don't have more money than you know what to do with, if you don't have household help to take care of the details. In other words, if you're like most of us, you have a major challenge to the functioning of the microsystem and to the relationship of that microsystem to other settings, which may be stressful. Try going to work if you have a demanding job when you've had about 3 hours of sleep, and when you left the house, your spouse was in tears and the baby was screaming uncontrollably. But you have to be there on time. Try having a good relationship with your work setting when that's the situation that you're in. I don't want to scare you away from having children. Just wait till you're 40. I'm sorry? 50% of marriages, it's about 48% now, of first marriages end in divorce.
48% are after post-child.
The question is, what percentage of those are after child? A large percentage of them. It's a kind of moving target because divorce statistics change. They're also difficult to track. But the things that I think are pertinent are that some divorces happen before children. Some of them happen in the first couple of years because you realize this was a total mistake. You know, the Britney Spears phenomenon. Oh, we got drunk, we're old friends, so we got married. You know, this is not a good basis. The next spike comes with two preschool children. People have one, it messes up the relationship, they don't deal with it well, so they have another one to make it better. Someone once said that one of the least effective strategies in dealing with problems is to keep doing what you were doing that didn't work, hoping that somehow it'll change and it'll start working. So you have another child, and the dissatisfaction grows and grows and grows until there are two kids present. You can't deal with the microsystem. The mesosystem has become much more complex with preschools, daycare, schedules. The financial resources are dwindling fast, and couples don't have, they fall apart like that. Couples don't have the psychological resources or skill to maintain the relationship. Those couples that don't have the skill break up. There's another peak. When you have two young adolescents, if you survive this period, then have two kids going through puberty at the same time. Pubescent kids create conflict within the family as part of their job, and it's in part a reflection of their intellectual development as well as their emotional lability. And some marriages that did get through the two preschoolers don't make it as kids are going into adolescence. They start to fall apart then. This is also the period during which marital satisfaction is at its lowest. If you just look at the satisfaction in a marriage, it generally follows a U-shaped curve. So it's pretty high during the honeymoon. It goes down with each child. And this is that period. You have a couple of adolescents. And then they start to leave home. And this is the empty nest. We've talked a little bit about what your parents are doing now that you're out of the house, right? But there's also this little bump of empty nest divorces. Some people hang on until the kids are gone. And when you leave, they look at each other and say, "All right, I'm out of here. You know, thanks, but no thanks. We're gone." So this is rough. Some studies will find pretty good support for this. It's important to look at what the stresses are in a couple relationship that lead up to divorce. It usually takes you a year or two or three of not being happy before you get to that tipping point before you divorce. So you can look at the one with two preschoolers probably started with not really adapting at all to the changes in the microsystem that come along with parents, with children, when you become parents. This one with two young adolescents probably started when one of the kids started going through puberty and creating stress for you. This one probably started a long time ago, and now the time is right. And then there's the other one over here. I've probably told you that story. But the 90-year-old guy who goes into the lawyer's office. And the lawyer says, "Hi, Charlie, how are you doing? You know, looking pretty fit for 90. And what brings you here today? He said, well, bring my wife in. We want you to do a divorce for us. The lawyer says, what? How long have you been married? 68 years. 68 years. And you want a divorce? Yep. Yep, it's time. You're 90, your wife is 88. Why a divorce now? We wanted to wait till the children were dead. Didn't want to affect the children. Okay. That's a bad joke. It's a really bad joke. Don't worry about your grandparents. They won't divorce. Well, they probably already did. All right. So, the stress of parenting creates problems in the microsystem. Divorce is one of the consequences of that. Extramarital affairs are a consequence of that. One of the people I nominate, usually, is a former husband of a friend of mine who announced after she came home with their second child that he missed her, but he felt so guilty that he just had to tell her that while she was in the hospital with the second child and her mother was taking care of their first child and the rest of us were supporting the whole family, he was having an affair with... Anyway. It was not a good timing to announce that he was having an affair. And they didn't last more than a couple of years later. So affairs, abuse of spouses and abuse of children often begin with a, again, I'm going to be stereotypic about male-female roles, with a wife-mother not being able to keep a child quiet, happy, and satisfied, and at the same time keep a husband-child satisfied and happy. So some people respond to children's normal behavior, crying, fussing, colic, whatever they might have. The challenges of the baby's behavior, some men, particularly men, expect the mother's role to be to keep the child perfectly happy and to be the wife that you used to be. And that's a totally unrealistic expectation. But some people, when you're not doing what they expect you to, and they're irritated by a crying or demanding baby, take that out on the mother or on older children because they don't deal with their own frustration well. So abuse, conflict between the parents, affairs, and divorce are what children bring into the world with them. It helps. And I do recommend that you, in fact, recognize that it's the appearance of the child that creates those stresses that are challenging for parents, so that you don't blame each other. What couples do is, you can't blame a child, right? Children are innocent, and so it's not their responsibility. So it must be the other parent's problem, the other parent's incompetence. But if you recognize that the child will create these stresses by its existence, it will create these stresses, and you need to work them out with each other in a way that's supportive, but also recognize that they come with the child. And you create a relationship that is supportive and acknowledges the fact that the child is creating these stresses. They don't tell you well enough, clearly enough, that children stress a marriage. They are the biggest stress ever for marriages. Conflict is created by children and parents' reactions to children. Yeah. You just take the kids on the honeymoon. And if you have started... And this is true for second marriages with kids, too. If you start with kids as part of the package, then you don't build up an image of the other person as an unrealistic single person out there who has nothing to do but take care of you. You may build up an image of the other parent, the other person, as a person with a child who needs you to rescue them. And many women rescue men with children. Having a child is even better than having a dog to attract people in the park if you want to get dates. So there was a movie about that, right? Somebody, who was it, borrowed it? About a boy, yeah. The main character is a single man who borrows a child because he's discovered, or somebody's told him, that it makes you more attractive to women. And it does. It really does. But part of the motivation for women in being attracted to men with children, the good part is they expect this person is a better human being because he's interested in children. And we are, if we're interested in children, better human beings. At least from a woman's perspective. But part of the motivation is often to rescue the child from the incompetent father. That's not a very good basis for creating a couple relationship, because it starts with, you need me, you're not competent, and your children need me. So I advise against that one. But what happens is that if you're creating the relationship with a person who already has a child, you've got a package. And if the person has been honest about the fact that the children are more important than you, you know your place. And you come into a ready-made situation then, and if you're both in that situation, there's strength in numbers, so two parents can deal with it reasonably well. And it has the potential to make you more realistic and to allow you to then add additional children with only a minimum amount of additional stress. But keep in mind that the divorce rate for second marriages is higher than for first marriages, and highest of all for second marriages with pre-existing children. The step-parent role is the hardest role. And we're going to talk about that in more detail. But just think about the micro and meso system. As it evolves, you got the mom, the dad, the child, that's a reasonable one. And then they divorce, maybe there are two children. And then you've got another mom, and maybe she has a child. And they've got part-time children. And then they create a child, not the two children, but the mom and dad. So each of these people is coming into being a partner, being an ex-partner, being a parent, being a step-parent. The dyad with the biological child and the step-child is much more complex than the one for being the second couple parent. Okay. So this one is typically stressful, the ex-partner parent. This child is perhaps sharing parents. This child has two people who have other children, so there's conflict potentially between the children. Stepmom has an ex out there, maybe. The microsystem gets incredibly complex because the roles are all different. If you are a parent to your own child and a step-parent to another child and a parent to a child with a second partner, you have three different parent roles because each of them is different. And each child has a different set of relationships in his or her family of origin. So the children are all responding differently because they have different sets of parents. The children in the second marriage have equal relationship to the two parents and different from each of the stepchildren, first marriage children. And the relationships among the children are different based on gender, birth order, and who's got legitimate two biological parents in the family. I got two biological parents and you don't. And I get them all the time. And my step-siblings have to go someplace else, so I'm king of the roost. Because I get just these two parents. I don't have to deal with any of those. Okay. The bio child is in a favored position for the couple that are declaring their love for each other. The step-siblings, half-siblings, have different parents, and they're not together. And those relationships may be conflictful. The bio child in the second family has the favored position, the parents who are happy with each other, and gets to be there full time. So the roles of the children are different in each setting within the second marriage. It's incredibly complex. And in the second marriage, you've got the exes, sometimes two of them, who don't get along with you, who are jealous of you, who don't legitimize the step-parent role. They're competing. Okay? Bio-dad in the first family is competing with step-dad in the second family, who is also now bio-dad in another family in which there may be a step-dad or a step-boyfriend who's really bad because he's not even legitimate. And so he's competing sometimes in both directions with dads, other dads. And the mesosystem connections are just mind-boggling. They're just mind-boggling. I don't know how step-families do it, but it's fairly easy when they do it well. They're very impressive. But when they don't, it's easy to see that the cards are really stacked against them. And that makes it very easy to understand that second marriages with children are at even greater risk than the ones that start off fresh as first marriages with no children. Okay. Some of you have been there, right? What it does for the kids is teach you to be very flexible. That's the potential, that kids learn to be very flexible because they can keep the schedule, they figure out how to keep the parents from each other's throats. They keep everybody happy. They learn to communicate well sometimes. That's the potential. Okay. What Galinsky is doing in the book is taking a constructivist view based on creating an image and then constructing relationships with each child who comes along and reviewing that image as the reality changes. So in Galinsky's constructive approach looking at parenthood, what she's describing is the reality of the dyadic relationships with the child, and the child is driving that transaction as it changes. The parent is regularly changing his or her image of the child and of him or herself as a parent. And so this is constant. And the couple together are dealing with their duplicate or parallel relationships with each child and with each other, and potentially, but not necessarily, revising their image of each other to incorporate the reality of child rearing, and they're supporting each other. In a healthy relationship, they're supporting each other. They're monitoring the changes. They're aware of what has happened to them. They're aware of how the children are changing, how the spouse is dealing with it, and they're supporting each other in becoming better and better parents. At the same time, they're supporting each other in maintaining their relationship. In my advanced family systems course, one of the things that always happens, and it's been happening over the last month or two, each of the students is interviewing a family in the community with children. And it's predictable, always happens, and it's happened again this time, that when we do an eco map for those families, we find out where everybody in the volunteer family spends time, all the settings. Okay, so you will use Bronfenbrenner, those of you who are going to take that course. You will use it again. All the settings, the relationships among those settings, and then which ones are stressful mesosystem connections, and which ones are supportive mesosystem connections. What happens with people with young children is that the couple often, in creating that list of their settings, their eco map, come to the realization they don't have any that are not defined by children. They do not do anything that does not include children. And then what we hope happens is that they realize that that's sick, or it's not very good for the relationship, if the parents and the children are a closed activity network and never do anything. The kids sometimes do things without the parents while the parents are at work, but the parents don't do anything as a couple without children. And when you see a couple that has two children and they have done nothing, and this is not an exaggeration, they have done nothing without children as a couple for 3 years, it's fairly easy to understand why the couple relationship is taking a back seat and is becoming less and less satisfying. It's very important for couples to recognize that you don't keep that dyadic relationship thriving unless you do things as a couple, or if you're doing them with children, you have to be focusing on the couple, not the children. Yeah, I'm not saying that closed activity networks are all bad. I'm saying that if everything is based on the children, and when you're engaged in the activities, you're focusing on the children, without focusing on yourself as a couple, then you're at risk. Okay. So couples need to be able to focus on themselves, and sometimes that means getting away from children regularly and seeing the relationship as important. Okay, Galinsky is tracing the development of the child and looking at its impact on what's going on in the couple. Let me, if any of you know good animation techniques, I'd love to have an animated way to present this instead of drawing it. So I don't know anything about animation techniques, so I don't do this. Okay, so we have the mom-child relationship, and we have the dad-child relationship, and we have the mom-dad relationship. Both of these are going to continue across time. It's the same child, but it's a different relationship. What Galinsky describes is that the child's behavior at any particular stage is likely to present different challenges to each parent. So she's describing in her six stages, nurturing, authority, interpretation, interdependent, she's describing specific kinds of challenges that the child presents to the parent-child relationship. because each parent may have different ways of dealing with those challenges. To illustrate, during the nurturing stage, many women have very little difficulty with the nurturing stage. That's what they wanted a baby for. You want a baby so that you can nurture something, and you've been preparing for this since you had your first baby doll. And nurturing comes easily, and you know how to do it. The nurturing stage may be very new to dad. Sitting, holding a three-month-old for an hour at a time in a rocking chair watching the sunrise is one of some dad's favorite activities. Wonderful experience. You have to sit down. You have to slow down. Holding a sleeping baby reduces your heart rate and your blood pressure and increases the endorphins in the brain, reduces stress hormones. You want to take care of your stress? Hold a sleeping baby for a long enough period of time that it will actually affect the functioning of your body. You want to be really mellow? Do it every day, two or three times a day. Lots of dads never do that. The nurturing stage is a major challenge for a guy who can't sit still. A guy who's not comfortable just holding a baby, holding its head, stroking its cute little blubbery back. It's hard. So a stage that may be very satisfying for one parent may be very uncomfortable for another parent. And the fact that they are responding to the challenges and opportunities in that stage differently may create conflict between them. The fact that he doesn't enjoy it and isn't comfortable with it annoys her. Or, if she's not a nurturer, and there are women who are not comfortable with babies, and he expects that she will be, and she's not doing it enough and griping while she's doing it, that's going to create conflict. So their relationship is reflecting the differences in the way they respond to the opportunities and challenges of the particular stage. They move on. He's pretty comfortable with authority, saying no, helping kids understand what the limits are. He's got that firm voice. He's a no-nonsense person. Two-year-olds like that. They expect that. Dads can set the limits. They're clear. They reward kids, and they provide a lot of fun and challenge and adventure for kids, but they're also clear about the limits. That's the opportunity in this stage. That's the demand. Moving from the nurturing stage to the authority stage may be a major challenge for other people. They're real good at the nurturing, but frustrating a child, setting limits, saying no, is not comfortable for some people. And the people who are most comfortable being Earth Mother, huge blanket, are the very people who are going to have trouble when the kid starts to say no and run away from you. They don't know how to deal with it. They've been nurturing this kid for a year and a half. They've been doing all these wonderful things, and now the kid is telling them no? How can the kid possibly do that? A kid you've nurtured and been really just absorbed in is supposed to continue to love and appreciate you, right? Except developmentally, he's not supposed to. He's supposed to tell you no. He's supposed to push all the buttons. He's supposed to make you set limits. He's supposed to require that you put your foot down firmly so that the two of you can work out a nice new transaction based on his new skills and his need to be safe and your responsibility to keep him safe. And safe is better than comfy. Safe is more necessary than comfy at this point. You're going to run into that again at puberty. Yeah. Look at one that's not so comfortable. Some people don't set limits well. Some people aren't very good at helping kids understand the limits and allowing them to test them. Some parents are pretty bad at that. If a kid tells you no, which all kids will do if they're healthy. When they're two, they'll tell you no, and that's important. They should. But if you turn around and swat the kid because he said no, you're having difficulty with the authority stage. Swatting a kid is not an appropriate way to set limits. But some parents don't know appropriate ways to set limits. So one of them starts swatting the kid. The other one looks at that, says, well, wait a minute, you can't do that. The conflict starts between the parents around discipline. In an abusive relationship, it's not surprising, I think, given this kind of model, that in an abusive relationship, women will take abuse from husbands, but when they see their children being abused, they will leave. And if you talk to women who've left abusive relationships, they will often describe that they stayed and they stayed and they stayed and they took the abuse themselves and they just figured maybe I deserved it, or if I just behaved better, I could keep him happy and he wouldn't abuse me. But when he hit my kid, when he hit our child, then it really got to me. And then I knew that it was dangerous. Then I knew I shouldn't be taking it. So the protective, nurturing responsibility of the role of mother puts the abuse in a different light and gives it a different interpretation than when the abuse is directed to you. So that's one way in which this triad responds to the authority problems that the abusive parent is likely to have. Abuse, authority problems are part of the same package. Okay, so what Galinsky is describing is the fact that you have this dual track. Each parent is responding to each stage based on his or her own history. So dad had a relationship with his mom and his dad, and mom had a relationship with her mom and her dad. They're now being compared. They're now being compared to each other. So mom is comparing her husband to her father, who's comparing his wife to his mother, and they're evaluating their own backgrounds and trying to make sense of them as they try to sort out what's going on in the relationship. Which is why in family systems, we say you have to look at three generations to understand what's going on in the family system. You need to know mom and dad's relationship in the grandparents' generation to understand the relationship that's going on with the child here, because you need to know where mom and dad came from and what happened to them as they went through each of these same stages. What kind of parenting did they have? Okay, is that clear? You've got the parents' own experience as children and adolescents informing how they're going to do it with their own child. Then, you want to make it more complicated? Add child two. So along in here, along comes child two. Recycle to the nurturing stage while you have a kid in the interpretive stage. Now parents have two sets of relationships. If they dealt badly with the nurturing stage the first time around, how are they dealing with it the second time? Who's doing the parenting in the interpretive stage more effectively? Who's having difficulty with it? Do you have two kids in stages that you're having difficulty with as a parent? And if you had difficulty as a couple when one of you was having difficulty nurturing, are you going to have that again? So the difficulty, the conflict between you is extended now for another child's worth of that stage. And that's the family context for development. Okay? That's what you grew up in, one of these. With three generations, at least a history, you may never have known your grandparents, but they created your parents, and that's how you understand them, okay? By understanding your grandparents' relationship. Conflict between your parents based not only on who they are, but how they were parented, and what you present to them as children. And your parents also had a birth order. It's important to know whether each of your parents was firstborn, middle, last, only. How does their relationship mesh with their sibling order? Because their sibling order determined in part what their parents were experiencing as they were growing up. Was your parent the oldest, in charge of everybody, the only? Everybody paid attention. Or the baby? Are they in a familiar order? If dad is a firstborn and had younger sisters, and mom is a second or third born sister who had an older brother, they know how to do this relationship. He's the firstborn brother. She's the little sister. They did this as children. They know how to do it as a couple. But if she was the oldest sister and didn't have any brothers, and he was an only son, and then they get married, he's not an only anymore, and she doesn't know how to deal with brothers, they don't know how to do this relationship. They have to create it from scratch. Okay, that may be better than replaying something that's familiar to both of you from your childhood. If he's a firstborn, if either of them is firstborn and the child is the same gender, the tendency to identify with that child and that child's position and understand that child and that child's position is greater if the kid is in the same sibling order you were. If you were an only child, you know that position, but when you add a younger child or two, understanding the baby role with older siblings may be more difficult for you. How do you understand a baby if you never were one? Only children are never babies. They're in a very special position. On the other hand, if you're the baby in your family, you're the youngest of three or four or five, the firstborn may be a little foreign to you. Maybe a little scary. When the last one comes along, you know how to deal with that. That's the one that you're comfortable with, because that one's in your position. You're familiar with that. So having felt sorry for yourself all the way along because you were the baby, now you can feel sorry for your own youngest, and that will affect the relationship that you create, the kind of reciprocity you feel with that child, the kind of affect. Okay. Oh yeah, then there are the sibling relationships. You add those dyads too. And each of those dyads, the relationship of the older child to the younger child and vice versa, is going to affect the parental dyad and the dyad between the parents and the firstborn. So that system becomes incredibly complex. One of the issues between first and secondborns and thirdborns and fourthborns is that they're developing at different times. So those relationships are between developmental unequals. The power between the firstborn and the secondborn, or any later born, the power differential between siblings is always large. The oldest have more power in the relationship. Reciprocity is changeable. If two kids are at roughly the same stage at the same time, the reciprocity may be high. A three-year-old and a five-year-old can play along pretty well. They're both pre-operational. They both have language. They may be interested in the same things. They can engage in fantasy play together. They can appreciate each other's roles. They communicate okay. But 2 years later, when that three-year-old is five and still pre-operational, and the five-year-old is a concrete operational seven-year-old, they're on different planets. They use language differently, they think differently, and their reciprocity is greatly reduced because they don't understand each other. The same thing happens then, they go into another 2 years, they're both concrete operational, and they're best buds again in elementary school. Until the first one starts to become formal operational in adolescence, and the second one is still concrete operational, the formal operational kid thinks the concrete operational kid is primitive. And why did you get so dumb all of a sudden? And the concrete operational kid doesn't have a clue what the formal operational kid is thinking about or talking about. So they go their separate ways with a greatly reduced reciprocity. 2 or 3 years later, they're both formal operational. They now understand each other again. And the reciprocity goes up. Affect follows the reciprocity because it reflects conflict. And when kids are at different stages and don't understand each other, they're dealing with the change as they were understanding each other and now they're not understanding each other. That creates conflict and the affect becomes more negative. So all the way through the timeline for the family, these relationships between children are shifting just simply based on whether or not they can talk to each other and share the same interests. That relationship, as it waxes and wanes, becomes more and more negative or more and more positive, affects the parents who are dealing with the children's conflict either as a united team or letting it create conflict between the parents. So nothing within the family system across time, nothing is stable. And the whole microsystem, the whole set of relationships and roles is constantly changing. From the time this couple, actually from the time they were little children, but let's just put them together as a couple, from then until empty nest and beyond, that family microsystem is changing in predictable and understandable and systematic ways. It's not chaos. But you do have to follow the whole pattern. Remember, Bronfenbrenner said in one of the hypotheses, if you're going to understand what's going on in the microsystem, in the family, in the home, you have to understand each role, each dyad, each relationship as it changes across time. It always makes me tired just to think about it. And we haven't even put in the grandparents currently and the relationships that everybody has with them. I watched one family that was very interesting. The grandmother, in this particular case, had a wonderful relationship with the grandchildren when they were little. It was almost like she was reading minds. A kid would develop a new interest, and a week later, a package would come from grandmother with just the right book or the right doll or the right prop or the right whatever it was. it was mind reading. It was really fascinating. And both kids really enjoyed that very much. And that continued up to close to adolescence. And during adolescence, one of the children continued to develop interests that were very close to the grandmother's. The other one went off in a very different direction and developed interests that the grandmother, in fact, not only didn't share, but didn't value. And she was getting older at that point, during that period of time, and less tolerant. And she began to favor the child who was doing things that she valued and shared, and actively disfavor the child who was doing things that were different from what she could value. And as that child's interests got more and more diverse from hers, she began to get more and more obvious in her preference for the child who shared her interests. And that child became an expert at tapping into that favor, and the other child just made grandma angry. And that continued through adolescence into college. And grandma was sending random money and sponsoring trips and airline tickets and stuff like that for the grandchild that she favored, and ignoring the other one who was doing nothing wrong but pursuing interests that she didn't have. How did I get involved? The parents of the children came to me because they were having a major fight about how to deal with grandma and help the children deal with the fact that the disfavored child was saying, I'm not going to grandma's for Christmas. She doesn't like me. I don't know why. Heck with it. And was not going to play the game of sucking up to grandma, as she put it. And the other one was, she wanted to do everything with and for grandma because she was getting all the goodies. And the parents were at each other's throats about how to deal with grandma. They didn't get divorced. I love it. When a plan comes together, they figured out how they needed to deal with grandma. They worked that out together, saved their marriage, were unable to get grandma to change her behavior, but they told the kids that they disapproved of what grandma was doing, and they helped the kids understand that it was totally out of their control, and they explained it to grandma. Grandma got mad at everybody, didn't talk to anybody for 3 or 4 months, and then came back around and still continued the favoritism, which probably she continues now. And I suspect her will. I should check with them if they know what's in her will. I'll bet she's going to give everything to the favored grandchild. But you think about a grandparent out here in the mesosystem having a different relationship with each child, creating conflict between the children, creating a different experience for the children, creating conflict between the parents over a long period of time. That's not a trivial influence on how the family system operates. Okay. Your brain stretched enough? Those are the notes. Okay. In Galinsky, as you read through these stages, the question is, what happens to propel the child and the parents into the next stage? In the first case, from image making to nurturing, that one's real simple. The kid is born. And then you have to figure out what went on in this birth, and then you have to figure out how the microsystem is being changed. The later ones are a little more subtle than that. But let's look at the nurturing stage in the couple of minutes that I have left. What do you have to do? You've got this kid. Here it is. You've got to take it home. Scary, scary, scary. You've got to take it home. You're responsible now. And you have to figure out how to develop an attachment to this baby, which doesn't look like the Gerber baby and doesn't look like what you thought you were going to get. And it doesn't behave the way you thought it was going to behave, unless you were a human development major. And the parenting role is not what you expected. And you have to redefine all of your relationships to incorporate the baby into them. You have to redefine your relationships with your own parents, who may resent the fact that if this is the first grandchild, you've propelled them into the next generation. They may not like that. Others will embrace it so much that you have to beat them with sticks to get them out of the house. And at the same time, you have to figure out how to maintain your own sense of self, how to incorporate the new roles, all of these changed relationships. And creating a relationship with that baby that you can't send back. And parents often report looking at the baby, going in to watch it while it sleeps, one of the great joys in life, sleeping baby. Never wake a sleeping baby. The parents will actually go in and watch the baby breathe and be amazed at the fact that they created this. This connects them to the great stream of life, of DNA, all the way back to whenever DNA began to be formed. You're connected to it now. And we'll move on to the authority stage. Wednesday.